Welcome to the Climate Hour. I'm your host, Bob Grove. Today, we're going to talk about the amazing impacts of a little community orchard. First, there's basic carbon sequestration. That's just a big word for stopping global warming by taking carbon out of the air. Trees are nature's natural carbon dioxide scrubbers. They take CO2 out of the air and use it to build things like trunks and limbs and other tree stuff. And then there's food sovereignty. Another big word for having control of your own food sources. In today's corporate farming system, genetically modified foods are picked green, irradiated to prevent spoilage, then shipped halfway around the world to high-priced grocery stores. Food sovereignty means growing tasty, nutritious food that you can just walk up to the end of the block and pick from a tree. Food that tastes better, that's healthier, and that doesn't have a massive carbon footprint from being shipped around the world. And then there's community building, bringing people together, creating a shared work that builds relationships and creates a sense of accomplishment. That's a lot of meaningful, positive impacts. We're joined today on Zoom by Erica Cratefill, co-executive director of The Giving Grove. Hi, Erica.
Hi, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Florence Williams, science journalist and author. Hi, Florence.
Hi, Bob. Great to be here.
And Matt Bunch, horticulturalist with The Giving Grove. Hi, Matt.
Hello, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Florence, I'd like to start with you. Can you tell us why it feels good to be outside?
Sure, Bob. We know that there's a lot of emerging research in this area, and some of it is interesting and kind of surprising. One thing that scientists are finding is that even after 15 or 20 minutes outside in a pleasant natural setting, our nervous systems really change. We start to reduce our production of stress hormones like cortisol. Our blood pressure drops several points. Our respiration can slow. Something happens where we just feel a little more comfortable. And I think there's still a lot of debate about whether that's perhaps because of the pollution-reducing effects of trees, for example. But we're hearing the sounds of birds and of wind instead of annoying human-caused sounds, like traffic. That puts us at ease. We know that our human perceptual systems evolved outside. So on some levels, we understand what we're seeing in a natural setting. Our eyes, our ears want to kind of open up so we can take in, you know, these signs from around us. Whereas in a city, we kind of want to shut out too much stimuli. So there's just something really comfortable about becoming the sensory animals that we're designed to be.
Sounds like a lot of behavioral benefits in spaces.
Behavioral benefits and also physiological benefits. We know from large-scale epidemiological studies that people who live closer to green space actually live longer. If they're pregnant, they tend to have longer gestation, healthier birth weight babies. We know that there are fewer stress-related diseases, like migraine headaches, like cardiovascular disease, in populations that live closer to parks and green space. And this is after adjusting for things like income and education.
Erica, I believe you have a background in social work. So I'm curious, do you find that there are therapeutical benefits to growing orchards?
Yes, I do. I am really passionate about this work because I think there are so many ways that it benefits communities and people. We had an opportunity about a year and a half ago to meet with some orchard stewards, so volunteers who help care for orchards that use their orchards very intentionally as therapeutic spaces. There were people who work with youth who have experienced trauma, and they use the orchards as a space for kids to get outside of a typical therapist office and really talk about what's happening with them and what's happened in their lives and use the orchard as a natural setting. They talk to us about how much more relaxed the children are, about how much easier it is for them to share and open up, and how they could really relate to the changes they see in the orchards as time goes on, with changes they see in themselves as they begin to heal from the trauma. We also have examples of orchards that are at residential facilities for people who are experiencing treatment for various medical issues, including mental health, and how therapeutic it is for them to spend time outside, connect with nature, and really get back to their roots and begin to connect with where their food comes from and how the earth works.
What about physical benefits?
We see a lot of physical benefits too, because these orchards create green spaces where people can gather, spend time outdoors. Just the act of gardening, caring for something that's living, the movement that that requires can provide some really important physical benefits. And then, of course, this food that they are growing in these orchards is grown in a way that avoids all the artificial pesticides and chemicals that we would see in commercial orcharding typically. So the food is healthy to eat right off the tree. It's safe to eat right off the tree, and it brings healthy calories into communities that often don't have access to healthy
food. So I'm hearing a lot of benefits, both mental and physical. Florence, are there other mental health benefits? And I'm thinking about things like loneliness or stress or even creative mind space, mindfulness. How do green spaces affect our minds in that way?
Yes, I'm so glad you asked that. We know from some of the research, and for example, psychologists at the University of Utah, that when we are open to the beauty around us, almost the power of awe, it takes us out of our own heads. It can take us out of our own rumination. It can make us feel connected to the greater world around us. You know, if you think about looking at the Milky Way or seeing a wild animal, you know, if you're fortunate enough to be in a wild enough space like that, all of a sudden you're no longer thinking about your problems. You feel like perhaps a small grain of sand in the universe. And there's been a lot of recent research just showing that that actually leads to resilience. It helps us feel less lonely. It can be an antidote to things like grief and heartbreak. I was really surprised to discover some of that data. You know, we don't hear of beauty as an antidote to heartbreak, but I think it's very compelling, and it makes sense if you think about it.
Bob, that was something we heard a lot during COVID, during the pandemic, when people were required to socially distance and feeling isolated, that these community green spaces were places where they could safely gather and they could connect with one another, and they could interact with people they might not otherwise interact with. And we've heard a lot of really beautiful stories about people getting to know one another in these green spaces and being able to spend time together in settings where they might otherwise have felt very isolated. And we've seen that play out as well.
Yeah. I just want to corroborate that being in public horticulture since 2000, I see how people react in these outdoor spaces, and oftentimes with plants that I have planted over the years too. So I get a little bit of extra gratification, but they are also getting gratified or somehow becoming at ease, or their sense of wonder is definitely piqued by what they're seeing. So yes, all of those benefits are definitely ancillary.
So obviously lots of benefits to people interacting with green space. Matt, in your role as horticulturist, let me ask about the environment. How do these green spaces impact or help the environment? I'm thinking about things like, you know, perhaps air temperature or humidity or soil. What does an orchard do to those things?
Yeah, so, an orchard will definitely cool that space. And so let's say you have an empty field that is surrounded by parking lot. You add 15 trees. All of a sudden, you know, a few years later, that space has become somewhat shaded. You have the transpiration of the plants that is helping cool the air. So yes, from the cooling perspective, from the taking that storm water off of our streets, for sure. Now, of course, the big shade trees give a lot of those benefits, but some of these orchard trees will get to be 25, 35 feet tall. And then we start talking about some of the nut trees that we plant around, like chestnuts, like pecans. Those end up becoming real canopy trees and will create their own cool oases within the urban heat island.
Do you have a sense of how much that cooling is? I mean,
I don't know. I don't do the research on this, but I would say, Florence, you probably do.
I recently saw a study conducted by the Trust for Public Land showing that neighborhoods within a 10-minute walk of a park are 6 degrees cooler during the heat of the summer. So, you know, that's a substantial difference. You know, makes sense that if you have grasses, you have trees, You know, there's going to be a cooler effect than if you have, say, a playground at a school that's asphalt.
And that's actually air temperature. So I assume there's also that taking the direct sunlight off of you. So that, I mean, there's also a surface improvement in temperature.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So Florence, I'm going to shift into urban spaces. What are the benefits of building orchards in urban spaces specifically?
Well, I think, you know, we just mentioned that urban heat island mm-hmm. effect, ameliorating some climate change. You know, there's an incredible equity issue when you talk about that. I mean, we know 100 million Americans do not live within a 10-minute walk of any kind of green space. So when you have any kind of, you know, orchard or park or playground, not only are you improving people who may use that playground in a school, but you're actually improving the environment for the whole neighborhood. There's some interesting studies that came out of Philadelphia taking very degraded parks and public areas, greening them with plants and trees, and showing up to a 30% reduction in symptoms of depression and anxiety in people who lived within those neighborhoods, and also a significant reduction in gun violence. So there seems to be this rather dramatic behavioral and psychological effect of having better, improved, and more parks in a particular neighborhood.
Now, Matt, what's your experience? I mean, when we're building an urban orchard like this, what's the role that the city plays in that? Does government get involved?
Yeah, well, each one of these orchards is different. And so in some cases, we do have local municipalities involved via Parks Department. And so when we're talking about sort of the design phase, we think about the destination of this orchard. We think how are people going to get there, one? And that can be a major equity issue, because if there are not sidewalks to that destination, how do people get to that? And in some cases, we plant trees. We can't put in the sidewalks. But that becomes a major conversation in getting to and from orchards. But then once you're in that orchard space, then it's talking about how people move around in that orchard space. And so how would we like them to move around? And having pathways through an orchard, I think, is very key. There's one site in particular that I think of. It was a plain field. We put trees in that the organization that we partnered with followed with pathways. All of a sudden, this field was now getting walked in, whereas before it was just getting mowed. It was not there for the public. It was just for the lawnmowers and the mow crew. So now all of a sudden you have people engaged in this activity of simply walking and talking. And then, oh, there are some fruits here. And oh, this is a jujube tree. So all of a sudden there's more mental stimulus. There's more physical stimulus going on just by that space that's been created.
So really the city's role perhaps is providing the property if it's park related, but then providing that access, whether that's sidewalks or some sort of public transportation, bike lanes perhaps, to bring the people to these community spaces.
Yeah. And sometimes it is also providing some of the other infrastructure like water, for example, which of course is key to getting any of these things established.
So how do you encourage community involvement in these spaces? How do you get groups and individuals to take ownership of an urban orchard?
Right. Well, that is also going to be sort of site by site, but most of the time, people approach us and they're looking for a way to improve their community, or they have green space within the community that they need some help with some ideas, maybe figuring out what to do with this green space. And so putting those fruit trees in, yes, you know, that's one thing to do, but how do we help them? You know, we will give them site assessments. So let them know what the current vegetation is. And we talk about soils, talk about drainage. And then we'll work with them and also identify other people within the neighborhood who might be interested in caring for some of these fruit plants. We also provide a lot of education that goes along with taking care of these fruit plants. You know, every plant you need a little bit of education on if you're going to cultivate it. Fruit trees, it just so happens there's a lot of intense education that you need in order to raise this from a small sapling into a nice, productive 400-pound-a-year apple tree, let's say. So there is a level of education that we provide those stewards, the folks that care for them.
Erica, do you think orchards, urban orchards specifically, have an impact on community health?
I do think they have an impact on community health. We specifically look to work with neighborhoods that have the least access to fresh food. So neighborhoods where there often is not a full-line grocery store, where there is not access to get the fresh, healthy food that many of us have more ready access to in other parts of the city. And so by making that food available, you can really begin to address some of the diet-related illnesses that people face, and really be able to also create spaces that bring people together and begin to address all of these other mental health and behavioral issues that we've been talking about throughout this this conversation.
So obviously health, nutritional-related issues, that fresh, natural, organic food, you know, close mm-hmm. to home, also community-level mental issues. I mean, things like engagement, collaboration, how does the orchard promote those?
Yeah, there have been some research and some studies that have shown that anytime people are working together on a community project, when they are collaborating and when they're working towards a common goal, it really improves those social connections. And those social connections, we know, are so important to making our communities healthier. We can begin to find things in common that we have with people that we didn't previously know. So begin to connect with one another over a shared goal to improve a community space, and really begin to feel this deeper sense of connection that you might not otherwise have in your.
Florence, do you think a connection to an urban green space, to nature in general, can that affect our motivation, our willingness to take action on issues?
Yeah, I think action is a great word. You know, when you have an orchard, it requires nurturing. We have to plant these trees, we have to water them, we have to prune them, the fruits have to be harvested. We can see cause and effect. We can learn about consequences of our own behavior. There are fewer and fewer, I think, examples of that and resources for that, sometimes in our neighborhoods. You know, we are losing public spaces in our neighborhoods. And so here's a place where we can come together and actually see that we're making a difference. So many kids now in urban neighborhoods don't feel hope. They don't feel that they make a difference. And even just watching a tree provide you fruit because you have worked on this tree, I think is a very, very powerful message for these kids in particular.
We've also seen examples where having the orchard space helps the neighborhood come together to make other improvements. So there was one example that after the orchard was installed and the neighborhood came together to care for it, then they developed a sport court next to it because they saw that by working together and creating this community asset, there were so many benefits and they wanted to keep expanding that. And we see in other orchards where gazebos and picnic tables and little free libraries begin to pop up because the community really makes it their space, sees the benefit and wants it to be an asset that everyone can enjoy.
More than just food and you know, these environmental health things, solitary, it sounds like, really becomes a community center, a space where the community comes together to share time.
Absolutely. There's an orchard not too far from our office where I like to go for lunch often when the weather's nice. And every time I'm there, it's just fascinating to see all of the people who come and use the space, all different demographics, people from all different sorts of backgrounds who are drawn to this beautiful green space in an otherwise very urban, very paved part of the city. And it's so fun to see them come together and interact. And they don't necessarily know who I am, but they'll come up and start talking to me about the space and how they use it and how much they enjoy it. And it's just really refreshing to see that happen.
So all the amazing things of a little orchard. I mean, I'm hearing all these health benefits, bringing communities together, mental benefits, all these great things. Florence, you've said that nature should be a right, not a privilege. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the more that we are learning about how having access to nature makes us healthier, calms our nervous system, helps us recover from stress, these are critical human aspects of resilience. We all need to be able to optimize our mental well-being in order to be our best selves, in order to contribute to society, in order to be citizens, in order to have agency. So I absolutely believe this, and I think it's under-recognized. You know, I think people think, oh yeah, it's nice to be able to live on a golf course, you know, if I'm lucky enough to do that. It's nice to have an expensive hotel room, you know, with a view of the ocean. But no, this kind of access is absolutely integral to our being human animals. You know, we are part of nature. And when we forget that, and when we cut ourselves off from it, the consequences for ourselves as individuals, but also for ourselves as communities and societies, is, you know, greatly impacted.
So I hear you saying the privilege is to be able to have a house on the beach or live on the golf course. And obviously everybody
That's right.
can do that. The right comes into play with our public parks and these community orchards, eat and green spaces.
Recognizing that these benefits are important for everyone. And in fact, if you look at some of these studies coming out of Europe, we know that it's the most economically deprived neighborhoods that actually see the greatest benefit from having access to green space. So in some ways, having a nature space is a social leveler. It kind of evens the playing field in terms of people's long-term health. It's the people who have access to this green space who are going to live longer. And in fact, it's the equivalent of having more income. So I think that kind of social leveling effect is something that's really underappreciated.
Sounds like it. Erica, your thoughts on social leveling?
Yeah, I think everything that Florence is saying is really important to who the Give and Grove is as an organization, because we believe this is a real equity issue. We all know that the historical effects of redlining, that even though that was outlawed decades ago, continue to affect our cities even today. Neighborhoods that were redlined, so where there was no investment for a period of time under federal organizations, are still areas with the least access to green space, are still areas with the least access to fresh food. They have the least amount of tree canopy, the highest rates of pollution, the highest rates of asthma. And so anything that we can do to begin to increase the green space, increase the tree canopy, improve access in those neighborhoods will have a really meaningful effect for generations to come.
I'd also like to add there, sometimes, and I know it's kind of true here in Kansas City, the green space actually may be within some of those neighborhoods, but it is being able to access that green space. And when you have to walk on a road, especially a busy road, to get to that park, and then when you get to that park, there may not be shade, there may not be benches, there may not be playground equipment. So that is one thing that I know many parks departments are focusing is the quality of life in some of these disinvested areas.
Mm-hmm. And I think we're addressing this, but let's actually put the label on it. Florence, do these spaces help address climate equity issues?
Yes, I really think they can start to do that, especially for some of the topics we've talked about in terms of temperature, in terms of stress resilience. You know, look, I mean, living in a warming world is anxiety producing and provoking. I think we're especially seeing this with our young people. Being able to provide a space of relief from some of that anxiety, being able to appreciate the beauty and nature that is still here. There is still a lot of nature in the world, and it's wonderful and fantastic. If that helps us wake up in the morning feeling refreshed, having gotten a good night's sleep, then we're able to fight the fight. You know, we don't want to just retreat into, you know, a hole of despair. It can actually help renew us seeing this kind of beauty on a regular basis.
You're listening to the Climate Hour. I'm your host, Bob Grove. We're speaking with Matt Bunch, Erica Credefill, Florence Williams, about the amazing impacts of Little Community Orchard. Erica, can you talk about how community orchards impact food security?
Absolutely. We know that there are many parts of our cities that don't have access to fresh food, where the only food available to them may be highly processed, and where there are high rates of food insecurity, meaning that the families and individuals don't necessarily know where their next meal will come from. And there may be a lot of transportation barriers for people who don't have a way to get to a grocery store or a food pantry or any other resource that isn't within walking distance. So these orchards are designed to be within walking distance of those who need access to food the most, so that there is no transportation barrier to access the food. And the food is distributed for free within the community, so there is no cost barrier as well. And it really gives people an opportunity to experience something they may not otherwise. Many people never have the opportunity to eat an apple straight off the tree or to eat a pear straight off the tree, and they probably don't appreciate how different it tastes and how good it is when you eat it straight off the tree. And if you're part of the group of volunteers who help care for that tree, who has helped nurture that space, then it's even the more rewarding to enjoy the literal fruits of your labor by eating food straight from the tree. And so these spaces create sustainable sources of fresh, healthy food right in communities that typically have the least access. The trees that we use can often grow food for 20 to 30 years. So this isn't a short-term solution. This is something that can serve the community for decades and begin to have an impact on those issues of food insecurity that remain stubbornly prevalent across many of our cities.
Matt, I wanted to jump back to these heat islands, this concept of heat island for a moment. I understand what those are. I mean, urban areas are going to naturally generate and hold more heat. But I'm curious, when we put an orchard, trees in an urban setting like that, how do they respond to the heat island? How do they affect it?
That's a great question. And over the years, I've observed a lot of this. You know, even within your own yard, you have a microclimate. Yet then you're in a city and you have buildings, you have asphalt, you have hills, you have valleys. You have all of these unique little microclimates in which you can actually grow some things that you normally would not be able to grow in some of the larger agricultural hinterlands. I will take, for example, here within the Kansas City area, over the past 5 years, we have had late frost. And these late frosts have ended up ruining some of the peach and Asian pear crop as you get outside of the heat island. And that's kind of our major interstate system. So you get outside of there, those areas of frost pocket, they basically froze out the crops. Yet you get into these heat islands, the frost doesn't settle, the temperatures don't get as low. So I guess we can call it a benefit that can be attained from these microclimates that is basically caused by the heat island effect. And we can use these buildings that radiate heat off of their south side. That heat could get reflected back to, let's say, a fig plant. And so that will instigate production a little bit earlier. So in a lot of cases, the fruit plants respond quite well to this heat island.
It's kind of cool because the plants are cooling the heat island, so there's a benefit, but then the heat from the heat island actually helps protect and nurture the plants, if you will.
Yeah, I don't recommend doing this whole scale. Oh, but wait.
I know Matt and Eric, you're in the Missouri, Kansas City area. Florence, I think you're in Colorado. Is that correct?
Yes, I'm in Denver.
Yeah, Denver. So variants, do you have a different take, or how does Denver respond to these urban orchard type things?
Well, we certainly have a significant heat wave, in the summers mm-hmm. these days. I believe there is a Giving Grove orchard here in Denver. I know that there's a wonderful community gardening effort working, for example, with refugees in Denver. I'm really gratified to see more of these programs popping up. And even beyond the city, I mean, there are nonprofits that are taking urban kids, up into the mountains, because if you grew up in Denver, you've never seen the Milky Way, you know, imagine that. You know, I'm a huge fan of the Girl Scouts, actually, because it's really taking this idea to scale of, you know, getting kids out, you know, learning about nature, using their bodies, you know, for adventure sports, learning about, you know, mountain biking and rock climbing. So I think, you know, it's not just about the food or about the farming, but it's really about this different wholesome relationship to nature in a way that so many kids don't get growing up now.
And what I'm hearing, this concept of orchard, urban orchard, that is not just in the Midwest plains, it's also at the base of the mountains, altitudes, things like that. It's kind of a universal scheme. Erica, so tell us about the Giving Grove specifically. You know, what's your mission? What are the goals of the group?
The Giving Grove started in Kansas City in 2013, and it was founded by a group of volunteers who worked together in an emergency hunger relief program. They were concerned about the sustainability of those kinds of programs, and they wanted to find a way to have a longer lasting impact on food security in urban neighborhoods. So they spent a year looking at different models around the country, talking to experts in urban agriculture and food access. And they landed on this idea of helping neighborhood leaders to grow their own sustainable sources of fruits and nuts right in the neighborhoods that typically have the least access to it. So these perennial crops are able to produce food for decades and become a really long-term solution for some of these food access issues that we see. They started this program, as I mentioned, here in Kansas City under the umbrella of Kansas City Community Gardens, and the city really embraced it. And within just a few years, there were 100 of these little orchards all over Kansas City producing huge quantities of food. And they began to hear that as important as that food access was, even more important was the way that these sites were bringing people together, were building community, were allowing people to have access to green space and tree canopy and meet their neighbors and do something together that's very meaningful. So they felt inspired to share the program with other cities and piloted expansion to St. Louis and Omaha. They learned a lot from those pilots and then developed a plan to reach 20 cities by 2025. So this year, we will have Giving Grove programs in 15 cities, from Atlanta to Seattle, from Dallas to New England. And it's been really exciting to see how each community has made this program their own and has adapted it, made it culturally relevant to their community, and has really embraced it. So there are now more than 550 of these community orchards all across the coast that are part of the Giving Grove network. And each of them are supported by a local partner organization like Kansas City Community Gardens here or Denver Urban Gardens in Denver. And our network at the Giving Grove works with each of those partners to make sure these programs are sustainable and continue to serve their community.
Does a group, does some city, some group reach out to you, or does Giving Grove target a location to go look for a group?
Yeah, it really works both ways. We're seeking to serve cities that have at least 75,000 residents who face food insecurity that are in growing zones 5 through 8, where we know the portfolio of trees that we work with can do well. And where there's a partner like Kansas City Community Gardens or Denver Urban Gardens who can house this program and make it sustainable over the long term. So in some cases, we're reaching out to organizations we've identified that we think could be a really great partner and bring a lot of expertise into our network. And in other cases, organizations are reaching out to us. It's been really exciting as we built this network to see how the information and best practices and ideas flow freely and intentionally between all the cities. Each organization that becomes part of our network, each of our partners brings some really exciting expertise and background and then can share that with the others. So it's been fun to see that happen.
So you've got orchards coast to coast national. Do you have any international plans or any orchards outside the country?
We do not currently, but I will say we have had inquiries from several countries, and it is not out of the question. But today we are still focused on the U.S.
Yeah, we have a lot of listeners around the world, so we will explain how to reach out to you at the end of the show. Matt, I know you've got a long history as a horticulturalist. I think you were with Powell Gardens for a lot of years, and then you worked with Kansas City Community Gardens. From your perspective, I mean, what makes Giving Grove unique? How is this program unique and different from the other places you've worked?
Yeah, so I actually got brought in on the very early conversations before this became an organization. And, you know, a number of things that we talked about, we talked about the fact that fruit trees, they do require more care than a shade tree. That it is, you're growing food. So, you know, you think of a vegetable garden, well, you're going to be out there in your vegetable garden maybe 3 or 4 times a day. Now, you're not going to be out there that much for the fruit tree, but once a week at least. So one, the conversation was around appropriate, zone appropriate varieties. So making sure that the apple tree that was planted was at least for here within Kansas City, it's not going to be a Honeycrisp apple, or it's not going to be a Pink Lady apple. They're wonderful apples in the grocery store, but you put them into the soil here, they will not grow, or they have a lot of disease problems. And so having something that is very disease resistant and going to be easy for the grower itself, that is key, because that comes to the second part, and that's the stewardship. Oftentimes, who we are engaging with, they're more maybe neighborhood leaders, and they're less gardener. And so they need to be equipped to take care of that plant material, and it has to be somewhat easy or easier to maintain than let's say a Honeycrisp or a Fuji or a Pink Lady apple. So having the right plant material and then engaging with the neighborhood, engaging with the stewards, educating that stewardship team on how to maintain trees. So this is it's social and horticultural and definitely educational the whole way. Without the education piece, this really wouldn't be able to happen.
I'd like to add on to what Matt said about the stewards. They are absolutely the backbone of this program. It would not exist without them, because they are the people who are in the orchards week in and week out in all sorts of weather, caring for their trees, keeping an eye out for potential pest or disease issues, and then making sure the harvest is distributed to their community. So each of the Giving Grove orchard sites typically has at least 2 people acting as stewards. So that's more than 1,100 stewards across the country now who are part of this network, and they are the ones who really deserve the credit for these orchards being successful and serving their community.
Matt, you kind of touched on selecting trees that are appropriate for the soil or for the climate zone, that kind of thing. Do you find you're adjusting the process for climate change? Are you looking at what maybe is coming down the road and maybe seeing trees that may have had to be grown further south in years past that can now be grown at a higher latitude?
Yeah, we definitely, and talking with all of the other Giving Grove program managers around the country, yeah, we're looking at that. And you know, being a horticulturist, I've always wanted to push the zone. And I think most people who are gardeners, they want to try, you know, the zone 7 plant in a zone 6. And you can oftentimes get away with that some. But yes, we're having to be more conscious of different varieties. For example, you can't really grow apples very well down in Texas or Georgia for that matter, because you just have too many days of heat or not enough chill hours, not enough hours of cool. And so as our winters kind of get shorter, as our heat waves become more extreme, we are having to evaluate fruits that will, let's say, maybe be more firm, less prone to sunburn, things like that. The other part about this is, you know, it's not just the plants, but it's also some of these insects. And I'm talking here about insect pests. So we'll take oriental fruit moth. It is one of the main fruit pests. Well, it it can have 5 to 7 generations in a growing season around Kansas City. Now you start getting more heat involved, then all of a sudden maybe you're up to 8 generations a year, or maybe you're up to 9 generations a year. And so then some of these fruit pests become more prevalent, and so you're having to adjust your plant selection based on the fruit pest. So yeah, oh yeah, it's a new world out there that we are having to look at and adjust for.
So what does the typical Give and Grow orchard look like? I mean, how many trees? What kind of mix of fruit?
Yeah, well, it's going to vary in each one of the affiliates, but sure. Here in Kansas City, I would say a typical orchard is going to be about 12 to 15 trees, and it will have Asian pears, it will have European pears, it might have some cherries, it will probably have a couple apples, maybe some peaches, maybe some blackberries. So that, I would say that is fairly typical on larger lot sizes. Then we could get into things like pecans, things like chestnuts. It depends on sun exposure, lot size, and then it depends on really what that neighborhood or that stewardship team really is passionate about growing. And sometimes you have to kind of warn people a little bit, saying don't plant too many peaches because you're going to have a lot of oriental fruit moth and peach tree borer, but we all love peaches. So you know, we have to, it's a balancing act.
So I'm hearing you talking about that mixture of fruit and nuts, and I hear that. You also mentioned raspberries. So there's also an understory crop of berries. Are there other things to grow? Is there like a vegetable component?
Yeah, well, other programs get more into, I would say, more of a food forest permaculture model. Exactly. Where they will do different layers, you know, maybe have strawberries, maybe have asparagus, maybe have rhubarb. And that's something that I think is certainly applicable site by site. Here within the Kansas City Metro, a lot of the groups that we work with, we're working on land that they don't mow necessarily. There is an outside mowing contractor. So you think of school districts or sort of larger nonprofit campuses. So mowing can always be a bit of a challenge when we're looking at the different layers of vegetation around some of these orchards. We do like to plant a lot of things in raised beds to help solve some of that problem, because then the lines are very delineated. And the person on the string trimmer on the lawnmower, they know to avoid that.
Sounds like, and Eric, I hear you saying there's a couple stewards for each of these gardens around the country. It sounds like they look at their local resources, their local environment, and build a garden that fits their community.
So, absolutely.
Erica, yeah, we're talking about food security and all these great things in the community. Can you give me a feel how much food does a Giving Grove orchard actually produce? I mean, in terms of pounds, in terms of meals, what does that look like over a year?
Absolutely. So an average size orchard of 15 trees can produce about 10,000 servings of food a year. So over the course of its lifetime, it can have a really, really meaningful impact if you put that out for 20 to 30 years of production. The 550 orchards that are currently installed in the Giving Grove network together will grow about 88 million servings of food over their lifetime. So we're talking about a pretty significant impact on getting fresh food into neighborhoods that typically have the least access.
That's a lot of food, a lot of benefits, amazing benefits, as I like to say. Mm-hmm. So how do groups, well, I think we've already talked about groups reaching out to you, or, you know, the Giving Grove saying, hey, here's a great location, let's see if we can find somebody there. We talked about our international potential down the road. Mm-hmm. Who would they reach out to talk to somebody about a, you know, opening an orchard in their local area?
Yeah, absolutely. We welcome people to visit our website, and there's a contact form that they can fill out, and we can connect them with the person who is either in their community or can answer questions that they have. Our website is givinggrove.org. And we're always happy to have conversations. We had a conversation recently with a group in Africa that's working on permaculture and had some questions about trees. And we do not have a Giving Grove affiliate in Africa, but we were able to connect them with some resources and answer questions. And then we've had conversations with groups in other countries and have been able to connect them with nonprofits working closer to them that have resources available. So always happy to have those conversations.
Let's talk a little bit about that community, that network. You referred to the Giving Grove Network several times. I assume one of the great benefits of this kind of network is that there is different levels of information at different places. I mean, Matt, you've got great experience there in the Midwestern area. I assume that there are horticulturalists like you in all these areas that can pool their knowledge and address people from Africa or other parts of the US that need information. How does that communication network work?
Yeah, so I would say, yeah, each program manager has a little bit different of a background, and some of them have approached this from more food forestry and permaculture. And so they have their background there and have gone and taken their permaculture design courses somewhere else. And so there is a very broad network with a lot of growing experience. And so we will all communicate sort of quarterly or just get back with each other on some of these things. As far as, you know, kind of the international question, that's definitely a little bit different. And I don't know how I could truly answer that one.
Erica, what's your thoughts on the communication, the network part of it?
Yeah, I think that's one of the most amazing parts about this. So all of the program managers gather quarterly for sharing information and best practices once a year in person, and then the other three quarters on virtual calls, and have speakers to address a topic that's arisen in several cities, and just to troubleshoot and say, here's what I'm seeing, what are you all seeing in your city, and how can we address it? And so we do that very intentionally at the program level, but we also do that across the organization. So we also have quarterly meetings to bring together fundraising staff, marketing staff, leadership teams from these organizations. We really want these programs to be sustainable and to serve their communities for many decades to come. And so we really try to strengthen those networks and those connections at every level of the organizations that we're working with to make sure that we continue to have the impact that we'd like to have. And then, you know, beyond that, we have advisors. We've been fortunate to work with many extension schools and other resources that we can draw on if there's a question that exceeds the expertise of our immediate network. There are a lot of other folks that have stepped forward to help.
Very good. Florence, I mean, science journalist, I know you're an author, you've published lots of books. How do you feel that groups, initiatives like the Giving Grove, I mean, how do they address the topics that you work on?
Well, I think they absolutely do. And it's so inspiring for me to actually see what the practitioners are doing on the ground. You know, I spend a lot of time talking to researchers, theoreticians, people who are often in the lab. And wow, I mean, it's just wonderful to hear about the work that you're doing. I'll say it's also making me very hungry. The pecans, the peaches. Yeah, but I mean, I feel like this is, you know, this is really what gets me up in the morning. It's knowing that the science is being applied and that there are people really benefiting from this. And I think as the research that I write about becomes better known, we're just seeing more and more programs like this. It's wonderful.
It's wonderful. So thank you all for joining us today. Where can our listeners go learn more about your work? And Erica, I know you've already shared your website, but share it again.
Yes, our website is givinggrove.org.
Okay, very good. And Matt, do you have a place you'd like for people to go to?
Yeah, well, once again, yeah, go to that givinggrove.org, but you know, more specifically, KCCG.org. That's short for Kansas City Community Gardens, and we were where the original program got started. We do have over 250 of these little micro orchards throughout the metropolitan area. If some of your listeners are in the area, they may know it.
Probably do. Florence, where would you like people to go to learn more about you or your books?
Oh, sure. I have a website. It's very simple, florencewilliams.com. There are links there to my books and also my podcast work. So thank you.
Good. Thank you. And thank you to our listeners. We welcome your questions and feedback. You can learn more about the Climate Hour at climatehour.net. That's climatehour.net. This is the Climate Hour. I'm your host, Bob Grove.